Good evening. Hi, welcome. What a great turnout. I am the person who's going to introduce you to the person who's going to introduce you to the person who's going to introduce you to the people who are speaking tonight. So I'm going to be brief. My name is Tim Nepper. I teach philosophy and religion here at Drake, and I direct the Comparison Project, which is sponsoring this event tonight in conjunction with Above and Beyond Cancer. The Comparison Project is an experimental effort in a philosophy of religion that is historically grounded and religiously diverse. Each year, we coordinate a series of lectures and dialogues on a religious theme or topic. This year's theme was religious responses to suffering. Still is, religious responses to suffering. We're funded generously by six donors, Cultivating Compassion, Richard Denny Foundation, the Des Moines Area Religious Council, Humanities Iowa, the Drake University Humanities Center, the Drake University Principal Financial Group Center for Global Citizenship, and the Medgray Fund. And I need to say, and I must take off my glasses for it, that the opinions expressed here do not necessarily reflect those supporters. I'd love to tell you more about the Comparison Project, but I'm not going to speak any more about it right now. I will send around an attendance sheet that Humanities Iowa encourages us to send around at our events. And I will introduce the next speaker. Who will introduce you to the next speaker? Who will introduce to you the speakers? Tonight's Comparison Project event features the creative nonfiction of two members of Above and Beyond Cancer's recent expedition to the High Himalaya. You may wonder what a creative nonfiction reading is doing in a public program on comparative religion. To this question, there is a shorter academic answer and a longer autobiographical answer. The shorter academic answer goes something like this. There's no neat and discrete distinction between what is and is not religious, particularly when it comes to how humans respond to suffering. And even if there were, a comparison of religious responses to suffering wouldn't be very well informed if it didn't consider how people increasingly respond to suffering in non-traditionally religious ways. The longer autobiographical answer involves my meeting of and friendship with an extraordinary man, Dr. Richard Denny. It was approximately a year and a half ago, that I first met Dr. Denny at the Iowa Author Awards Dinner. Little did I know at the time what kind of rippling effects this meeting would have on my life. Well, it is a longish story, but perhaps one too long to tell now. So suffice it to say here that Dr. Denny's inspiration and encouragement and support were instrumental in the establishment of the Comparison Project, and that it was in consultation with Dr. Denning that the Comparison Project decided to take its inaugural theme as religious responses to suffering. And on a more personal note, let me add that Dr. Denning's inspiration and encouragement and support have been of considerable significance in my own life, in so many ways. Ways that range from grace, to hope, to courage, to curiosity. Ways that Dr. Denning himself is probably not even aware of. Being with Dr. Denning is like this. Seemingly unawares and effortlessly, he radiates our most cherished virtues in such a way that they stick to us, inspire us, change us, improve us. Embarrassingly, I probably cannot tell you much about Dick Denning that you don't already know. He is the founder and chairman of Above and Beyond Cancer, about which you will soon learn more. He is the medical director of the Mercy Cancer Center, as well as the CyberKnife Radiosurgery Center of Iowa. He is the chairman of the Mercy Cancer Committee and the president of the Iowa Society of Therapeutic Radiology. He serves on an expert panel for radiation oncology for the American College of Radiology and is on the State Advisory Council of the American Cancer Society. And among many other honors, he was awarded the 2011 Philanthropist of the Year by the Central Iowa Chapter of the Association of Fundraising Professionals and the Lane Adams Quality of Life Award from the American Cancer Society. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Richard Denning.
Thank
Tim, I was just taken aback by that. What a blessing for the relationship that Above and Beyond Cancer has established with Drake University in many different ways, but especially in this way. Above and Beyond Cancer is a nonprofit organization that elevates the lives of those touched by cancer to help create a healthier world. As a cancer doctor, I've been through a lot of education and a lot of classrooms at South Dakota State University, Creighton Medical School, and I've learned a lot of stuff, but I can tell you that I've learned more about life from my patients and their families than I've ever learned in a classroom. When you or a loved one is diagnosed with cancer, it's like a 2x4 up the side of the head that reminds you what you already know, that you're going to die someday, and reminds you what you already know, that you don't know when that's going to be. And you embark on a journey where you get a team with you and you approach that journey, that adversity, and you get through it. And I can tell you that every cancer survivor that I have ever met has come through that journey with a greater sense of personal awareness, with a greater confidence and courage, and a greater understanding of mortality and the benefit of knowing that we're mortal can provide in terms of an inspiration to reorder our priorities, to live our dreams. If diamonds were as plentiful as grains of sand, they would be worthless. If we lived forever, wasting a day would be trivial. But we don't live forever. And it's because we don't live forever that makes today so valuable. The background of Above and Beyond Cancer. A lot of stars of alignment and a lot of serendipity. But in April of 2011, the first journey of Above and Beyond Cancer, a journey to Mount Everest Base Camp. 14 cancer survivors and 15 caregivers, some of whom are in this room. And it wouldn't have happened without the dream of Charlie Whitmack. And Charlie's here tonight, and Charlie's wife was diagnosed with cancer. And it was through Kate's cancer journey, and she's doing great, that Charlie and Kate both realized that life can be short, and if you have dreams, living them now is a good thing. And so one of Charlie's dreams was to do the world triathlon, to swim the English Channel, ride his bicycle across Europe and Asia, to run to Everest Base Camp and climb Mount Everest. And he wanted others to come along with him, physically and metaphorically, to show everyone what dreaming big could be. So we got together a few months before he started that journey and concocted the first journey of Above and Beyond. And I can tell you, we had no vision of a non-for-profit organization that was going to have any sustainability. And I can also tell you that I was not in the least bit surprised by the transformation that that journey had on everyone that was on that journey. I knew that was going to happen. I was really blown away, though, by the power that that journey had on everyone who just followed us via blogs and talks and the movies and the photographs, and the power that the journey had as a pebble to create the ripples that do the work. And so out of that journey came this realization that these journeys and the work that we were doing has the power to transform. And so that became just the first of what has been many journeys. And so in 2012, a group of 19 cancer survivors and 21 caregivers summited Mount Kilimanjaro, 19,000 feet in Africa. And then in the summer of 2012, a group of 5 cancer survivors and 3 caregivers participated in a race, a bicycle race, across America, a 3,000-mile bicycle race from Oceanside, California to Annapolis, Maryland. A 3,000-mile race in 6 days, 21 hours, and 17 minutes. You have no idea what you can do with your life if you reach for something above and beyond what you think you can achieve. All of these journeys are mind, body, spirit journeys. When one faces mortality, it really prompts us to think about meaning of life, purpose of life, and perhaps afterlife, or spirituality, or religion, or however you want to frame it. I also knew that suffering is a component of going through the cancer journey. Just as suffering is a component of every adversity we face in life. So this last journey that we did, that you're going to be blessed by hearing some writing from, I overtly wanted to address the spiritual issue. It's part of every journey that we do. But I overtly wanted to talk about it. So we had, on this journey to the High Himalaya, 19 cancer survivors that included Catholics, Protestants, Mormons, Jews, Buddhists, Hindus, agnostics. And we took time to reflect each day on suffering in the human condition as seen through the lens of cancer survivors, and also about compassion and the relationship between suffering and compassion. And as my friend, Father Frank Bagnano, would remind me, if we all spoke Latin, we wouldn't be surprised about this relationship between suffering and compassion. In Latin, the word for suffering is passion, as in the passion of Christ. And in Latin, compassion means with someone suffering. So it's through our own suffering that we recognize what suffering is, what it feels like. And through our own suffering, we recognize suffering in others and recognize what it's like to reach out and help someone with that suffering. The group that went on this last journey was amazing. 19 cancer survivors and 17 caregivers, aged 22 to 70. As I said, it included all the religions. It also included all walks of life. And it was a journey not about running up and climbing a mountain. It was about learning what the mountains and the cultures had to teach us about ourselves. We weren't even going to be in Nepal to climb them, just say. Our journey that we put together was going to go to Tibet, and we were going to circumambulate the most sacred mountain in the world, Mount Kailash. It's so sacred it's never been climbed. Not because it's unclimbable, but because it's so sacred. And we're going to go around this mountain. Well, 3 weeks before we left, the Chinese government revoked our trekker's permit to get into Tibet. So we reorganized the trip and did this spiritual journey, stayed in Nepal, up through the Khumbu. We stopped at every monastery, convent, shrine, and temple along the way. We had a Catholic priest cancer survivor, an Episcopal minister cancer survivor. We said mass, we participated in Buddhist ceremonies, and we reflected on what suffering and compassion is all about. And then we climbed three mountains, a 16,500-foot mountain, an 18,200-foot mountain, and a 20,400-foot ice-covered mountain with ice axe, crampons, and ropes. You have no idea what you And we took along with us Yasmina Madden from Drake University. Yasmina teaches creative nonfiction here in the English department. And Yasmina worked with the cancer survivors before we left on the journey. In fact, if you saw the Des Moines Register yesterday, you would have seen Yasmina standing at the top of a 20,000-foot peak in the paper yesterday. And she's worked with them afterwards their turn. And tonight, you are really in for a treat, as am I, to hear two of the cancer survivors as they read their creative nonfiction, their reflection on this journey. So that's the real purpose we're here. So I've already run over time, but I want to introduce Yasmina Madden.
And again, Yasmina teaches at the English department here, creative nonfiction, and has just been instrumental in helping all of us find our voices as we write our reflections of this journey. Yasmina?
Just very quickly, and I'm going to keep this short and sweet so we can get through this stuff. I'd like to also acknowledge, in addition to the sponsors Tim mentioned, the support of the College of Arts and Sciences, the Women's Studies Program, and the English Department, because they have very generously supported several of the writing projects that I am working on with Above and Beyond Cancer. For the past few months, as Dr. Denny said, a group of Above and Beyond participants has contributed to a great community workshop focused on narrative nonfiction. These writers, including our speaker tonight, Andy Fleming and Ruth Bachman, have created personal narratives inspired not just by their journey, their recent journey to Nepal, but by their experiences with cancer, survivorship, and advocacy. This workshop included local truckers and truckers from as far as Seattle, New York, Utah, North Carolina, Minnesota. And so in addition to thanking Ruth and Andy for their wonderful narratives, I would like to also thank all of the other participants in our workshop and all of the people who contributed to our reflections collection that generated over 200 pages of creative nonfiction, all from truckers who went on the trip to Nepal, with Above and Beyond. The emotional and intellectual risk that you guys have taken in creating and sharing your stories, not just here tonight, but throughout our community, is truly inspiring. So I thank you for that. And lastly, I would like to thank Dr. Deming and Charlie Whitmack, the Executive Director of Above and Beyond, for organizing and supporting the kinds of trips that engender these kinds of important stories. So thank you. You both. All right, so our first speaker tonight, Ruth Bachman. And in 2003, Ruth was a left-handed woman with a husband, children, and grandchildren on the way, and a vibrant community service career. Today, she is all of those things, except now, after a soft tissue sarcoma diagnosis, she is a right-handed amputee with a renewed purpose for her life. A speaker, author, and educator with a national reputation, Ruth brings a timely message about the one constant in life, change. Her book, Growing Through the Narrow Spots, is forthcoming from Pearson Publishing in May. Ruth serves as the chair of the Community Advisory Board of the Masonic Cancer Center at University of Minnesota. She conducts Healing on Purpose workshops for the university. She is a member of the Minnesota Career Cancer Alliance Steering Committee, and a contributor to the Minnesota Cancer Alliance Cancer Support Network, among many, many other service and advocacy roles. Please help me in welcoming Ruth Bachman.
Thank you so much for that warm welcome. Thank you for being here today. And I will try to get my electronics here going right away so that this will all work. And then the next thing that I would be wishing for would be a flat surface on this thing right here, because I have this handy-dandy thing that I always bring this thing when I talk, only it's not going to sit there. So I'm going to keep this underneath the desk, and whenever I need it, I will pull it out and share it with you. And I hope that you realize that whatever has been prepared for this evening, parts of it have been repeated in the comments that Dr. Deming has given you and also in my introduction. But I am so pleased to be able to be here to share this story with you. Thank you very much. Maybe I can sit there.
Nope.
You're good. Oh. Right. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry, the people over there can't see. Okay.
Milburn.
Oh.
There we go.
If cancer is a narrow spot in an hourglass, and I'm the sand, then I travel from the top through that tight spot to the bottom, the same sand, but with a different arrangement. When you go through a narrow spot, your sand is refined and redefined, sifting out interior resources not previously noticed and or called upon. Life is full of narrow spots, not all labeled cancer. However, cancer is a narrow spot that has given me the opportunity to look at life with a different perspective, not once, but twice. It informs the way I choose to live my life every day. In March of 2003, I was a left-handed woman, wife, mother, and a parent with health. I ate reasonably well, was physically active, had regular checkups, practiced yoga and meditation, attended church regularly, volunteered in the community, and even read to four-year-olds in two separate locations on a weekly basis. It has been said that expecting bad things not to happen to you just because of the good things that you do is like not expecting the bull to charge just because you are a vegetarian. There was a soft, non-painful lump on the inside of my left wrist that I ignored for about 7 weeks, hoping that it would go away. An MRI revealed a 6-inch mass beginning in my hand, filling my wrist, and extending at my forearm. Dr. Dennis Closey, a remarkable orthopedic surgeon at the Masonic Cancer Center, University of Minnesota, performed a biopsy and gave me my diagnosis of malignant fibrous histiocytoma, yes, I can spell it, the most common form of soft tissue sarcoma, a very uncommon form of cancer. Before my biopsy, I had actually joked with friends and family about not being the first reported case of this cancer. I had never heard the word sarcoma before that diagnosis, but I certainly knew the word cancer. I was entering into a narrow spot similar to one that I had experienced 12 years before, in 1991, when my younger sister, Kristen, had a reoccurrence of malignant melanoma that metastasized into her lungs and brain. She died a month before her 36th birthday. Kristen was the baby in our family, the sixth of seven children, and 7 years younger than me. In addition to me, my siblings, my parents, and everyone else who loved her, Kristen left behind a husband and two small boys. I spent nearly every Friday with Kristen during the last 5 months of her life. On one of those very special Fridays, Kristen said, "I don't know why we're doing this. We're creating memories," I answered, with tears in my eyes. We created precious memories together during those last months of her life. And the last thing that I heard Kristen say, 5 days before she died, was an answer to my question to a hospice worker facilitating a care conference with Kristen and her family. I started to ask, "Her breathing seems to be so labored and painful." And before anyone else could speak, Kristen answered, "Hurts like hell, but if you don't do it, you die." I could not for the life of me understand how something like cancer could happen to such a wonderful, bright, vibrant young woman and mother, my little sister, my dear friend. And at the time, I thought of cancer as evil. As I grieved her loss, integrating the harsh reality into who I was and how I experienced life, slowly but surely, over time, my opinion changed. My grieving journey provided me the opportunity to transform the loss into an opportunity for growth. A course in mindfulness helped me to learn to slow down, breathe deeply, and listen to my heart, to be present no matter what life would bring my way. After initially going kicking and screaming, I embraced the narrow spot. And with patience, persistence, and grace, learned to say yes to my life without Kristen. And then it happened to me. My sarcoma diagnosis overturned my hourglass and brought back the gut-wrenching fear and almost giddy disbelief that cancer was in my life a second time. I went home for my biopsy and gathered as much information as I could about sarcoma. According to the National Cancer Institute website, cancer is a term that comes from the Greek word meaning fleshy growth. I read that it is indeed a quite rare form of cancer. All sarcomas, and there are 26 different types, account for less than 1% of all malignancies. I also read that it is often misdiagnosed and is described as a silent killer because it fills the spaces available to it before it makes itself apparent. In a young person, it is often misdiagnosed, often with dire consequences. I read that there is no known cause for sarcoma, and it was when I read that in 15% of cases, amputation is the cornerstone of effective treatment, that I sat back in my chair, unable to focus on the screen of my computer. I took several deep breaths and did not read any words. I cried. The fact that this thing, this fleshy growth, was actually there, growing in my hand and wrist and forearm, terrified me. I had life to live. I was leading a trip to Italy with 8 friends in April and directing a musical at my church in June. My husband Dale was taking on the responsibility as president of the National Trade Association in July. Our daughter Anna was being married in August, and our son Brian and his wife were thinking of making us grandparents for the first time. You're probably familiar with the John Lennon quote, "Life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans." Dr. Closey informed me that my tumor was grade 4, the very high, very aggressive cancer cell. My prognosis was good, 40 to 65% survival rate, with a treatment package that included 3 rounds of chemotherapy, surgery, and possible chemo post-surgery. I asked the doctor several questions, including, "And what is the acceptable margin for resection?" A friend gave me that one. It means how much clear tissue do you need to take along with the tumor to feel that you have it all? With a look of gentle surprise in his Irish eyes, Dr. Closey answered, 2.5 centimeters, 1 inch, all around. I knew that the cancer already filled my wrist, and so did he. After a rather long, pensive silence, I then asked, "What will happen if I do not accept amputation?" The smile gone from his eyes, Dr. Closey answered, "You will die." He urged me to accept the unimaginable, to choose life without my dominant left hand. Making that choice would mean that I would accept something life-altering, disfiguring, potentially life-saving, but with no lifetime guarantee. Dennis assured me that the goal of my treatment was to be cancer-free. I asked, "If I were your wife or mother, what would you want me to do?" And he answered, "The difficult thing." When confronted with the reality of amputation, I needed to reframe my life and change my perspective. Spending time in solitude and prayer and meditation and moving from my head to my heart helped me to say yes to this difficult thing. My head knew that I would have a significant change in my body, and my heart knew that I would move forward and grow through the experience of cancer as I had previously done in Christmas. While my mind was still racing with questions, I made my choice and said yes to life. I trusted my heart, moving forward with faith and confidence in myself, my support network of family and friends, and my doctors. I was determined to achieve my goal to be cancer-free, right-handed and one-handed. Thinking that a prosthetic device would replace whatever was lost in surgery proved to be a grave misconception of the power of technology. Thus began my journey into the world of occupational therapy. In my best experiences, I worked with therapists who were creative problem solvers focused on my needs, with an understanding that I was a highly motivated, fiercely independent patient with a good sense of humor and no small amount of persistence and fear. In my worst experiences, I suffered from threatening didactic individuals focused on giving me the basic, perhaps routine solutions to my needs, rather than working together creatively at solving the problem at hand. My goal when I began this journey into one-handedness was to be able to do by myself all that I had done before. I learned quickly that I had to prioritize what I wanted to maintain in my life and put forth the effort to learn to do lots of things over again and in a new way. For example, I was not interested in quick and easy solutions to my questions about dressing myself. How will I tie my shoes? Just wear Velcro and slip-on shoes, was the answer. Well, how will I button my jeans? I asked. I'll wear elastic waist pants, was the unsearchable answer. How will I fasten my bra? Oh, just wear jog bras, I was told. Working with no fewer than 12 different occupational therapists before and after my surgery, I slowly but surely did the work necessary to learn to eat, write, shower, dress, put on makeup, cook, type, drive, and live in my home. I was also determined to continue to pack my bag and travel independently to Italy or any other destination of my choosing. My surgery was performed in June of 2003, 1 month earlier than planned, because the chemotherapy had no effect on the tumor. It was growing and not shrinking. The good news, bad news in that is that I didn't have to have chemo following my surgery, so I got to start growing hair. But if any cancer cells decided to move on elsewhere in my body, they were also unaffected. Even now, almost 10 years later, cancer dwells as an ever-present shadow on my life. A very powerful and proficient teacher with the potential for profound transformation. For a second time, this narrow spot called cancer had provided me with a difficult, arduous journey. Again, I initially went kicking and screaming, but eventually embraced the passage, including the steep learning curve of having to change dominance and discovering the realities of one-handedness. I was more than a little apprehensive about becoming a grandmother for the first time, 10 months after my surgery. A self-imposed narrow spot brought on by worrying about diaper changing, playing patty cake, and making French braids in a little girl's hair had me totally focused on loss, what I would have been able to do before losing my left hand, rather than on what was possible to accomplish with the right hand that remained. However, I have been blessed by the discoveries that my granddaughter Amy has brought to me. She was born after having a thalamic brain hemorrhage and has compromised use of her right side. Together, we make a perfect pair of Amy. Life is full of narrow spots. Not all of them as a result of a cancer diagnosis, and not all of them negative. They just indicate change. Change is the rule and not the exception. Small wonders happen every day. The kind that we assume, like waking from sleep or the sun rising and setting, and the kind that surprise us, like a rainbow after a sudden thunderstorm. We look at these natural changes with anticipation and comfort and even experience a bit of awe at their existence. Then there are all of those other changes that are out of the normal rhythm of life. Changes in our family and personal life, finances, employment, living conditions, health, and more. When change occurs in our lives, we think that we can control it. But the opposite is true. We can only control how we respond to change. Poet Stephen Levine wrote, "There is a grace approaching. It is an insistent grace that draws us to the edge and beckons us to surrender safe territory and enter our enormity." One of those moments of insistent grace beckoning me out of safe territory was a recent journey to Nepal with Above and Beyond Cancer. I was part of a group of 36, including 19 cancer survivors from 9 states who had experienced 14 different types of cancer. To look at us, we were an unlikely bunch of mountain climbers, to be sure. But climb mountains we did, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. The trip to Nepal, beginning 2 days after my 64th birthday, promised to be more physically demanding than anything that I had ever done before. In addition to traveling halfway around the world with 35 people that I did not know, there was the opportunity to climb three mountains in a majestic, awe-inspiring setting. And even though I had no previous experience with that altitude or with that kind of climbing, I signed on. Once again, I was saying yes to life and trusted those in my company to guide me where I needed to go. In the 14 days of the trek, we went 100 miles as the crow flies on rough, irregular, rocky terrain ranging in altitude from 8,500 feet to 20,400 feet. When I summited the first mountain, 15,806 feet, I found, I accomplished something above and beyond anything that I had ever done before. Ascending was difficult, but doable. I was part of a small group that kept a slow, steady pace, and I repeated the names of my grandchildren, Amy Robin Bachman, Joel Brian Bachman, Tatum Ileana Itman, over and over and over, in order to match my breathing to the rhythm of my feet. The trail was sandy with numerous loose rocks, and in addition to being steep, there were large rocks near the summit that were not easy to manage. I do not crawl well, or easily, with one hand to support me. I do not know if I said it out loud, but inside my head, I was most definitely saying, how am I ever going to get down from here? I was more than a little afraid. I began to imagine myself with a broken limb or two, and after a brief celebration, the summiters were ready to descend, and as the anxiety about how I was going to manage this necessary but challenging task increased, Sheriff Giles and Sherpa appeared at my left. Like a guardian angel, he calmly said, I am here to help you down. With my backpack on his back, Giles then gently held on to my remaining limb, I call it Stumper, and he guided me down the mountain with ease, confidence, and remarkable speed. We flew down, with Giles then steering me off the path more than on. I had complete trust and confidence in his direction, and I felt like a gazelle. Any trek in the Himalayan mountains is accompanied and supported by these most extraordinary people, the Sherpa. Sherpa have been described as the guardian angels of the Himalayas and are known worldwide for their hardiness and almost superhuman ability to perform at high altitude. Buddhist religion dictates the need to care for other living creatures, and our Sherpa took this requirement extremely seriously. They were all able to navigate challenging paths and climb mountains with what appeared to be little or no effort. And it was their keen awareness of their surroundings and the people with whom they traveled that I found most astounding and meaningful. The Sherpa noticed when someone was having difficulty or struggling on the trail, and they effortlessly, willingly, and compassionately offered help. Walking next to that individual, extending an arm or a hand for balance or support, and carrying the trekker's pack when they're prepared. If they noticed that someone was missing from a meal, perhaps because altitude sickness had gotten the best of them, they offered a bowl of soup or a cup of tea. The Sherpa were consistently and in every way present and aware. They were most definitely responsible for our safety. And I found our group of Sherpa to be the tenacious guardians, indeed, guardian angels, of our diverse and inexperienced troop of trekkers. What was there to be learned from their example, I wondered? Living in mountain villages as high as 14,000 feet with no roads or cars, Sherpa hike everywhere. There were groups of children, some not older than 5 or 6, climbing the same 1,500-foot slopes of rocky, uneven steps on which our group trekked. dressed in recognizable uniforms, they were going to or coming home from school, climbing the equivalent of 150 stories. Holding hands, laughing, and singing in a language with which I had no knowledge or understanding, the normal of these Sherpa children was far outside the realm of my experience. I thought of my grandchildren, whose bus picked them up at the bottom of their driveway to take them the 1.5 miles to their school. A stark contrast. Research has found that the Sherpa's ability and performance at high altitude is due in part to at least 10 unique oxygen processing genetic adaptations that help them thrive in higher elevations with low oxygen. Sherpa have more efficient metabolisms and do not overproduce red blood cells in response to thinner air. They have hearts that can utilize glucose and lungs with an increased efficiency in low oxygen conditions. They are, in part, genetically engineered to do what it is that they do so expertly. But there was something more to discover. At 6 a.m. every morning, they were cheerfully awakened and greeted. We were cheerfully awakened and greeted by Sherpa with hot tea. Namaste, tea, sugar? They would ask. Namaste, yes, two please. Done by. Thank you. I would answer. Then an hour later, they would return to collect their belongings for the transfer to our next destination. I only had to ask one time for help stuffing my sleeping bag into its compression sack. Definitely not a one-handed task. And after that, help was graciously extended every morning, followed by fitting it into my duffel, zipping the large unruly bag shut, and carrying it 30 to 40 pounds away to the awaiting yak transport team. My fellow travelers were more than generous in lending me a hand, and help was required with anything having to do with my right hand and arm once I was ready. Things like putting sunscreen on the back of my hand or pushing up or pulling down my sleeve are challenging at home as well as in Nepal. I did ask for help tying my hiking boots each day. This is something that I can do and did for the vast majority of my training hikes in Minnesota, but it requires the use of my teeth. And it's rather uncomfortable looking body position. When witnessed in the performance of this necessary task, people seem to want to lend a hand. And so I almost always willingly accept that. My intention was to be as independent as possible in the public, endeavoring not to have my obvious deficits be a cause for concern or imposition on anyone. Even though I recently read someone describe me as a woman who needed considerable help from time to time, I want to believe that I have succeeded in that endeavor. There are very few perks that come with amputation, and a little extra attention from the Sherpa is one that I have added to the list. There were numerous occasions where a Sherpa helped me to navigate a perilous section of trail, usually downhill. Karzang Sherpa was my left-hand man coming down from summiting the second mountain. Dylan, he's here tonight, a young rock-climbing aficionado from Iowa, not a Sherpa, but a guardian angel nonetheless, filled that role on the way down from the snow line of Injus Bay, the third and final mountain. It was freezing cold at 1:30 a.m. when our band of 24 intrepid climbers set out from base camp, which was at 16,500 feet, to conquer Island Peak or Injus Bay. Lakpa, our head Sherpa or Sirdar, had told us that the way would be rough, rugged, rocky, and vertical. We had practiced the previous day with part of the technical equipment necessary to make the summit. Crampons, ice axes, harnesses, ropes, and carabiners would keep us safe and assist in the ascent and descent over the snow and ice. My experience in the practice as I climbed up the rocky mountainside at base camp with only the harness and the ropes was initially confusing and also more than a bit fear-producing. This was something that I had never dreamed of doing before. A favorite definition of fear is false expectations appearing real. First, I envisioned myself falling forward, flat on my face on the hill. And then I thought I might fall backwards down the hill with rocks inflicting major injury on my person. As I relaxed and tested the equipment and tending Sherpa, who was close at hand, I could actually report that it was not just one hand possible, it was almost fun. Repelling down was a different story. More hair-raising than fun, but Tenzing was my guardian angel that day, and I held tight to his waist with my strong right arm as he did the work of repelling with me in tow. I was assured that if I did attempt the summit the next day, that I would be an expert hand. As we set out in the icy, biting, cold, dark of night, I found my usual companions and kept pace with them. At some point after a rest and water break, I was separated from those climbers and found myself between Cammy and Lhasa, two Sherpa who were equally instrumental in getting me to the Crampon Point of 19,200 feet. Crampon Point is where the snow line is in the trail, where strapping crampons, which resemble old-fashioned roller skates but with sharp metal teeth instead of wheels, we had to fasten those to our boots. And it was mandatory in order to maneuver across the surface of glacial ice and snow. There was a time deadline for reaching this point so that the summit could be completed before the sun was high enough to change the conditions of the terrain. In order to participate in the final 1,200 feet of the technical climb to the summit, you needed to reach Crampon Point before 6 a.m. On reflection, I realized that the Sherpa really wanted me to summit. They believed I could do that difficult thing. And they worked very hard to get me where I needed to be on time. Somewhere along the trail, Kirby exchanged headlamps with me when mine dimmed, and when I discovered that my borrowed camelback hydration pack had frozen, Tenzing bought it next to his body and returned it to me, ready for use. Lhasa was chanting prayers behind me, and Cammy was guiding and directing my climb among the rocks and boulders on the edge of Lhasa Shar Glacier. Up, he would answer when I asked, where now? I was the last of 13 to arrive. It was 5:30 in the morning, and I did not go any further. I had certainly set out with the intention to achieve the perceived goal, to strap on the necessary equipment, to trust the equipment, myself, the Sherpa, and my fellow travelers to once again go above and beyond anything that I had ever done before. But as I sat on the ledge watching the others eagerly and energetically prepare and begin the final ascent, I knew that I was physically exhausted, totally spent, after climbing a very steep and rocky mountainside for 4 hours in the dark. I knew everyone wanted me to continue, and I am loath to disappoint people. I simply had to stop. This was one of those times in my life when I willingly practiced self-care. I listened to my body and my heart and my internal guardian angel, and I have no regrets. I can only hope that Dylan made the decision not to summit for his own reasons, and not just because he knew that I would need help to get down. And I am certainly grateful for his help. I was not the only recipient of graciously bestowed kindness, large and small, handed out regularly throughout every day, and I cannot believe that there is anyone in our group whose experience was not touched by a Sherpa's hand. My intention was to be wholeheartedly present during the 3 weeks in Nepal, and my experience in previous group travel had taught me that adversity breeds contempt or community. There was obvious and not so obvious adversity in my experience, and I believe that there was abundant community. However, because of the physical demands of each and every day's journey, I found that trekking and climbing was a solitary endeavor. I was with others for safety and community, but when it came to navigating the path necessary to arrive at the next generation destination, I was alone, engaged in my own thoughts and experience, climbing mountains on the inside, emotionally and spiritually, takes as much, if not more, effort as the physical climb on the outside. I said yes to a narrow spot well worth the passage. The journey to Nepal with Above and Beyond Cancer proved to be a very powerful and proficient teacher. narrow spots are tools that provide us with life lessons that lead to compassion and wisdom. And I discovered new ways of managing and doing things, saying to myself, yes, this has happened. Now what? However, one thing I have long known but sometimes forget was affirming. Self-care. Being present to the voice of my Sherpa within is not a selfish act. The cornerstone of self-care is being present, slowing down, breathing deeply, and listening to my heart. Gently and honestly facing limitations, and either learning to do something in a new way, asking for help, or graciously deciding to stop and not do that thing. Accepting the help is a gift to the person offering as well as the person receiving.
He earned a BA from Hamilton College, a Master's of Education, and a Master's of Education from SUNY Brockport. Between those degrees, he dropped out of Emory University Law School and was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease and decided to follow a different life path. His mother passed away from pancreatic cancer, his godmother, also his aunt, from breast cancer, and his father is a prostate cancer survivor. Andy is involved with a number of innovative cancer advocacy groups, including Above and Beyond, First Attempt, Camp Good Days at Special Times, the Teens Living with Cancer, and Strong Memorial Hospital Young Adult Group. Please help me in welcoming Andy Fleming.
It's a huge pleasure to be here, and it's tremendous to be up here with Bruce, who's a fantastic speaker and amazing coaching partner. And thank you, Yasmina Craig, and probably the most wonderful and fun four-year-old, Fran, their son, you'll ever meet in your life. If you have a chance to get over there, it's a blast. Thank you for the comparison project. And students, you guys are really lucky. I got the tour of this school today. It's fabulous. People are so nice. And for the students that came to lunch, it was tremendous to see four great students when I asked, do you write when you don't have an assignment and no one asks you to? And they're like, yes. And that's the coolest thing ever, because we consume so much, but to produce is tremendous. And that's what this project has been really cool, is to get something out there into the world and get outside your comfort zone. I've never heard of creative nonfiction, and when I tell my friends, they think I'm crazy, like, but you make it up. it's truly something you have to earn. Where I work with my students all the time is I have even to say an emotional word. Here you can't. You have to earn it by your sweat and your tears and the grit. And it's been a great, great adventure. And thanks for all that bugging down. It's like a reunion coming back and seeing everyone, because your feedback has made this my piece what it is. And we were talking about the cliches of something being life-changing, and by rewriting and rewriting and rewriting, that's what really helped me probably overcome some things that I've been working through my whole life since being diagnosed. And tremendous. So without further ado, the title of my piece is When Cancer Comes A-Calling. I awake in the darkness of night, soaking wet. Opening my eyes, it's pitch black, and I can't see the wall that is 2 feet from the side of my bed, but I know it's there. I take my hands and run them over my body. I feel rivers of sweat flowing down my chest and legs. I touch my belly button and feel a small lagoon filling the hole. As my hands rise to my face in the darkness, I smell salt. My pupils dilate in the darkness, and they see water covering my hands as if I just filled them up from a swimming pool. I wouldn't believe I was having a bad dream, but this is multiple nights now in a row that I've awoken drenched in sweat, and I don't remember a single dream. My awakening life has and will become more of a bad dream than my nights. Over the last 3 weeks, I've become progressively more tired. I've always defined myself as an athlete. In the past 2 years, I was named academic All-American Honor Roll for soccer at Hamilton College and was on the championship soccer team with my Emory University Law School classmates. These past couple weeks, I go to the gym and leave early, dog tired, hardly able to walk straight up. I used to be able to run laps around the 3 mile loop in my village. Now when I go out for a run, I have to walk because I'm too tired to even jog. And when I return home, I collapse on the couch. This time, I'm taking a year off law school. I've worked as a legal assistant at a corporate defense firm and the Legal Aid Society. Just haven't found my niche, and I'm really concerned about taking out a lot of loans, and I'm not sure how it will pay off. I started my year off in fine fashion by traveling to Costa Rica for 3 months, spent time visiting majestic volcanoes, otherworldly cloud forests, and attempting to surf world-class surf race. After my Costa Rican adventure, I returned to Rochester to the corporate defense law firm in order to refill my dwindling bank account. I searched for my next adventure, and I secured a coveted position teaching English abroad. I was close to 2 weeks from leaving to go teach English in Florida, Peru, when I was awoken, struck in sweat. I kick off the down comforters that are covering my body to cool off, and I fitfully drift back to sleep. What do I think is going on? I'm thinking I don't really enjoy the law work, and that's why I'm tired. I feel something new and strange sticking out from above my left collarbone. I also notice something strange sticking out from below my Adam's apple, above my breastbone. They feel like gumballs under my skin, hard and circular. I'm fortunate that the law firm I'm working at, we have legal nurses on staff, because we do a lot of medical malpractice defense work. I ask a nurse to examine the strange bumps that are hatching below my skin. She says they may be inflamed lymph nodes. I should have them checked out because they can swell when the body is fighting something off. I'm a fighter. I'm an athlete. My body is strong. Come on, body. Work overtime to kick this illness. I go to my primary care doctor, and the physician assistant casually asks me what I've been up to, what I'm feeling. Let it know, I've returned for 3 weeks in Costa Rica, and I'm 2 weeks away from leaving to teach English in Peru. Protect myself in your head, and think she believes I have a tropical disease. This may be a good story to tell my friends later. I mean, tropical sounds exotic. She orders a blood test, I head downstairs to the blood nurses. I used to be deathly afraid of needles. I mean, needles hurt. And every time there's an anticipation of pain, followed by pain. I try to avoid both of these things. This time it's not so bad. The needle prick is quick, and my red blood flows rapidly into the flexion tube. I drive home wondering what invading illness my strong immune system is fighting. When I walk in the door, I receive a phone call that tells me I have to return immediately for a chest x-ray. My heartbeat increases, but not by much, and I'm not too worried. I've never experienced a major medical issue. I'm young. This is just a small speed bump in life. I jump back into my car and return at once. I really want to know what is wrong so I can fix it and get on with my life. I've always wanted to know the answers, and if I know what I'm fighting, then I can work at being healthy and going on adventures. I have the chest x-ray, and I discreetly ask the x-ray to try commission if they see anything. I know they're not supposed to tell me the results, but I really have to know. They tell me it looks fine, and I remain satisfied and calm. Following day or so, I receive a call that there's spots on the x-ray. They need to run more tests, and they need to set up an appointment with an oncology surgery doctor to do a lymph node biopsy. Time speeds up with doctors when things are not right. My thoughts begin to race. Things may not be fine. Could it be I'm not the finely tuned race car I thought I was? Am I now a used car? 200,000 miles of rusty metal parts the mechanic shakes or had to diagnose it upon a lift? Whatever I may be, I'm due for surgery. Never had surgery where I had to be put out, and here's to a new experience. I'm lying in the pre-operation room running a fever. Fevers are supposed to heat up and destroy illnesses. I've had a fever for over a week. When does something turn from being good to being bad? My surgeon is with me telling me about the procedure. He asks me to mark the spot where he will perform the surgery. I ask him to mark the spot, telling him he is a professional. He said I had to do it. I don't think he understood me. He is a professional and I want him to mark it. He tells me again I have to. Who's in control here? My doctor telling me to mark my body or me making the mark? I draw with a permanent black marker on the left side of my chest, right above my collarbone, that marks the spot where my doctor was sliced. I'm wheeled into the operating room. The medical facilities, there are a lot of waiting rooms, and then there's the area where the procedure takes place. This is very similar to sports, where there's a locker room and an arena. In athletics, the locker room is right, pumped up, ready to compete, and adrenaline starts to build. In the medical waiting room, I sit idly, often alone or with my parents, and I stew in my thoughts with only my anxiety building. In sports, I have a direct impact on how well I play and how my team competes. In this medical world, I am a passive participant, and my fate is wholly in the hands of others. The anesthesiologist has me count backwards from 10, 9, 8, and I'm up before I finish the countdown. I believe I occasionally drift through consciousness during the procedure, but I can't be sure in my clinical dream state. When I come out, my mom asks the doctor, the same doctor that performed her mastectomy for the cancer that invaded her breast, how it looked. She tells me he said it didn't look good. I'm really surprised she told me this right away, while I was still in the recovery room. This was unlike my mother, as she would always keep bad news from me and keep me safe. I wasn't even allowed to attend my grandmother's funeral. I try to put this out of my mind and I do a pretty good job. If I know what it is, so be it, and I can fight it. I also play a trick on my mind using the logic that the equal opportunity of the first medical professional saying my x-ray looked good until it didn't. Maybe this time it looks bad, and when the pathologist reviews the cell under the microscope, it looked good. In my life up to this point, I've been really good about not worrying about things until I asked you. Or maybe I was just really good at putting things off. This time, I'm starting to creep up the anxiety curve, and physically with my fever, exhaustion, and continuing night sweats, feel like crap. Not until a week later that my phone rings. Hello? Hello? Is this Danny Fleming? Yes. This is the nurse from Dr. Morris's office. Hi. Your lymph node results are back. Okay? You have Hodgkin's lymphoma. Tears begin to cloud my eyes. It's the beginning of winter, and I'm staring outside into a cornfield that has a light dust in the snow. I'm seated in a black leather bottom chair at the wooden table my mom puts leaves in to make bigger when we have family or guests over for the holidays. I'm 24 years old, and I'm already staying at my parents' house. I'm supposed to be out living in a major city, going out on the town, meeting new people, discussing politics, work, food, sports. I'm supposed to be getting my career off the ground. I was living a good life. My mom is next to me, pretending not to listen in 100% of my phone conversation with the doctor's office. This does not escape me that she is more present than she has ever been. She's trying to give me space because I'm a grown-up. She comes over as I hang up the phone. She looks distraught, with tears now coming to a critical mass as they leave the tear ducts and begin to roll softly on her beautiful face. I will always be her baby. She's trying to keep it together. We're all trying to keep it together. My mom, aunt, and dad are all cancer survivors. We know that it can be a difficult, painful journey full of nausea, exhaustion, sleepless nights, and fear that seeps deep into one's bones. We know this all too well. Now I, on the most personal level and immediate of levels, will know it all too well. When I was a freshman in college, beginning my first semester across the country at Willamette University in Oregon, my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer. I would often call alone, and I could hear the strength in her voice. I could also hear the fear. I made these calls to mom from a friend's room, where I knew I would have the privacy, because I would often be quiet with Ryan if I spoke with her. I chose to transfer colleges to be close to my mom. My mom chose to have a mastectomy, chemotherapy, and radiation. She seriously considered having double mastectomy, and I recall my parents talking about issues of sexuality. She wanted to throw everything at the cancer. She wanted to cut off her healthy breast so the cancer would never, ever have a chance to invade it. She fought breast cancer and survived. 2.5 years ago, she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and lived valiantly with it for over a year while she traveled to Costa Rica, Turkey, and spent a lot of time with my dad and friends. She took high-dose chemotherapy, hoping for a remission. She passed away April 1st, 2011, in her home. My father called me at work to say my mom has passed. My tears flowed, and I felt a hole in my stomach as I drove straight home. I sat on her bed by her side where she used to read me books. Her skin was wrinkly, like the wise brain that contains a lot of accumulated wisdom. Her skin hung loosely off her bones as her muscle and fat had been consumed by her body of energy to keep her alive. I placed my hand on her clavicle and said goodbye. I believe my mom's body was the home for her spirit. When she passed on, her body was an empty hollow, and her spirit went somewhere else. I don't know where her spirit is. Sometimes I feel it near me, but it is a nebulous feeling. I watched as the mortician, a friend of mine from middle school, zipped up the bag her emaciated entire body was placed into. And as the zipper closed around her, that was the last time I saw her face. My aunt, who was also my godmother, fought breast cancer twice, but successfully only once. My mom and aunt were best friends, and they talked on the phone daily. They often laughed together, and when I heard my mom speak laugh on the phone, I know she was talking to her sister. My father was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer when I was in college, and he has been cancer-free for over 14 years. He doesn't often, if ever, talk about it, and I often forget he's a survivor. He's certainly one heck of a caregiver, and I respect him greatly for the care and love he provided mom. My brother is the only one in my immediate family that has not had to fight his own battle with cancer. But he's surely been touched by cancer, and he raises money yearly to search for a cure and support survivors. More than anything else, I hope he never has to fight cancer. When I hang up the phone on the nurse, who has just informed me I have Hashimoto's disease, I look over at my mother. I know my mom would take the cancer from me and carry the burden herself if she could. I know this because she tells me she would. We embrace in a warm hug. I don't know what to say. My thoughts are racing and they're also clear. I don't think I'm going to die, yet my first thought is, who's going to come to my funeral and who's going to be happy to be there? Will they be grateful that they were able to pay their respects, or will they consider it more of a societal requirement and be disappointed they had to spend money and time to attend? My mind goes to thinking I should just walk out into the snow-covered field and just put one foot in front of the other as long and as far as I can until I fall to the ground and feel the kindness of the cold, hard earth. I've always enjoyed exercise, and I think how I appreciate the thought of exercise and the peace it brings me even now. I can just start walking into the world and keep walking until I die. I wonder if I've lived a life worth living for others, in the sense that I've done good things for others. Have I impacted people in a positive manner? Have I been kind to others? Do people appreciate being around me? Have I made them laugh? Have I done anything of importance to make things better? While my resume looks good on paper, I realize at a deep personal level that I'm lacking. I have not accomplished anything that will leave a long-lasting impact, and I'm not connecting with people on a deeply emotional level. I can be so much more. I file this away in my head. I go into the bathroom and I splash lukewarm water onto my face to wash away my tears. I look blankly at myself in the mirror. I always thought that while I could lose all my material possessions, no one could take away my health. I love pushing myself physically by racing bicycles, running trails, snowboarding, and basically being active in the outdoors. I feel most alive when I'm moving, when the wind is rushing past me. This is my greatest joy in life. The rush of endorphins that course through my body when I fly down a steep and rocky trail on a mountain bike brings me chemical pleasure. Pushing my physical and emotional limits when I summit a high mountain gives me mental pleasure. Often, it is the mind that gives out before the body does. Being in nature, running through the woods, unites me with the earth. Ultimately, sharing all these activities with my friends brings me great joy. I never thought my own body would deceive me to take away its own health. My white blood cells are growing out of control, And my doctor says that almost a third of my chest above my diaphragm is being taken up by tumors. My tumors. How do I fight myself? I have always focused on building myself up. How do I destroy these rogue cells that are really my own blood cells? I feel betrayed by my body. Who or what can I be mad at but myself? No one knows the cause of Hashimoto's disease. Smoking is linked to lung cancer. Eating fatty foods and not exercising is linked to certain cancers. So no one knows what puts people at increased risk for Hashimoto's disease. My great uncle, according to my mom, passed away from Hashimoto's disease. But doctors say it's not hereditary. Maybe this is good, but I don't have to blame myself or my relatives for getting Hashimoto's. But if there's no known cause of Hashimoto's, then what can I do to prevent it? This idea is much more scary to me. As I said, I'd like to know what I'm fighting. How can I fight what I don't know? How can I control what is uncontrollable? I'm about to have to become much more comfortable with the gray areas, with not knowing, with doing the best I can with incomplete information. I'm about to have to become much more comfortable with not knowing if I'm going to live. I'm not a gambling man in the stakes of my life. If I could walk away from the table now, I would. There'd be skin marks as I peeled away in the parking lot and I would not look back. I realized this is something I have to face head on. My oncologist, Dr. Boris, treated my mother and my aunt for breast cancer. Dr. Boris and I bond immediately, and I trust him. During my first meeting, he performs a bone marrow biopsy right in the office. Bone marrow biopsies are done to stage the cancer and see if it invaded the bone marrow, where blood cells are produced. I lie on the table, and he takes out what looks to be a 6-inch needle that he fills with Novocaine. He says it's going to hurt like a big bee sting. He stabs the needle into my right hip, above my ass cheek. He takes a scalpel, slices into my skin. He then takes a hand drill and screws it into my hip and into the middle of my bone to take a core sample of the marrow. I lie on my stomach with my face buried into the pillow. I refuse to make a sound. I imagine my friend Ethan, an Army Ranger who's deployed abroad, being interrogated and tortured. I put myself in his place and I refuse to say anything to my torturers, not even give them the satisfaction of making a sound. The drill is reversed out of my bone and Dr. Boris grabs a scalpel. He definitely uses the scalpel to dig out part of the bone to test. I continue to stay quiet, and both he and the nurse ask if I'm okay. And I can tell they're concerned, nor surprised, that I'm not making a peep. I say I'm okay, and Dr. Boris says, okay, now for the left side. When I leave the office, my backside feels like I felt hard on the ass, well, hard on my ass, while ice skating. I begin chemotherapy and I receive 4 drugs, A, B, V, D. Adriamycin looks like red Kool-Aid and is toxic to the heart. Bleomycin is known to cause lung damage. Vinblastine and dacarbazine round out the cocktail. Chemo is short for chemicals, and I was always told not to mainline needles filled with chemicals into my circulation system. The chemotherapy burns and scars my veins so they're hard to the touch. I lose interest in eating any of the foods I attempt to eat after receiving chemo. In fact, just the smell of these foods invokes nausea. I can no longer stomach Boca burgers and brie cheese. Just having them in the same room turns my stomach. I begin to not even like the taste of water. Until that point, I didn't even think water had a taste. After the chemo has pushed through my veins for the first 3 days, I lie on the hard wooden floors in order to make my bones ache. Take the focus off the nausea that is tying knots in my stomach. The pills they give me for the nausea cost hundreds of dollars, but they're worthless. I believe in the placebo effect, but the chemotherapy washes that away. Physical pain, my bones on the hard floor, tapping my head on the wall, to me this pain is better than the days of nausea caused by chemotherapy. In training for soccer games, by running sprints and lifting weights, I know that exercise breaks down the body in order to build it up stronger. I focus my mind on feeling the pain caused by the cancer treatment and believing that it is cancer killing the cancer cells so I can rebuild myself stronger than I was before. I have to have hope. I begin a month straight of radiation. well, have the weekend off. But that is because the radiation machine needs a break on the weekend. And maybe it's because the doctors need the weekend off of work. I have blue pinprick tattoos on my chest to help line me up on the table. Being blasted by concentrated doses of radiation changes the color of my skin from a healthy pink to a darker brown that looks like the flesh of rotting fish. When it's time to power up the machine and deliver my prescribed radiation dose, the professionals run into the other room, being protected by the lead walls, while I am only inches from the radiation machine. I'm alone in a gray windowless room on a cold table, and I hear a voice over a loudspeaker say to stay still as the radiation dose is administered. The radiation machine is housed in the dungeon of the hospital. This seems pretty medieval. Throughout my treatment, I read up on chemotherapy, radiation, and cancer. I consider juicing, taking large amounts of vitamin supplements. I go and see an Ayurveda doctor my brother recommends, who tells me to only wear cotton clothing, no synthetics, and should not wear a watch with a metal backing. I also receive tips and hunters from well-meaning friends and family. During my chemotherapy and radiation treatments, I remain as active as possible, learning how to play golf and tennis. Sports up to this point I had considered only for old people and ones that would only consider retirement. I take a tennis 1-2-3 class in the city. In the session-ending tournament, I battle a two-time champion to win the tournament. I still have a wicked slice in golf, and I truly suck. I pedal my bicycle to Canada with friends and camp on the shores of Lake Ontario. I consistently run and walk a park at snail's pace, and moving continues to feel great. I practice with the Nazareth College men's soccer team and make new friends. Enter road races, and now I'm more of a participant than a contender. I learn to enjoy the participation, even if I'm not finishing on the podium. Fighting cancer, though, is something I have to win. My competitive spirit allows me to keep my focus on this goal. People often talk about blowing life events out of proportion, and joke about whether it's a life or death situation. Clearly, most things are not. Well, in this case, it is my life or death. As a 24-year-old young adult, this is a huge revelation for me, and one that has a lasting implication on my life. I will die, and I may die sooner than my peers. Hoskins is a greater likelihood to return to me than for someone who has never had Hoskins. The chemotherapy and radiation I had puts me at increased risk for secondary cancers caused by the same treatment that saved my life. This scares the shit out of me, and it's also motivating. What I've learned is that when I truly realize I could die, then I can really start living. I took an existential philosophy class in college. Reading about it is slightly different than living it. 4 rounds of chemotherapy, 1 month straight of radiation changed me from the inside out. I can hope that I'm a better person. More importantly, I can take action to make sure I'm a better person. My life has changed the most by focusing not on what I want people to remember me about at my funeral, but focusing on how I want people to know me in the present moment. I am proud of my involvement in the cancer community. I've become an advocate for adult cancer survivors. I'm an ambassador, photographer, alumni board development chair for First Ascent, which provides adventure kayaking, surfing, and rock climbing for adult cancer survivors. I'm an angel with Irwin's Angels, where I mentor newly diagnosed cancer survivors and provide a supportive ear. I volunteer with campers in special times and have coordinated their young adult cancer retreats. This past year, I participated in an 8-week workout program for teens living with cancer. I also dropped out of law school, and for the past 6 years, I've worked as a high school counselor and coach. Focusing on the present moment and the positive events in here and now is something I try to do every moment. I really believe I have to live with purpose. I survived cancer. Many of the friends that I've made through my cancer journey and advocacy work have not lived. I do not believe that people get cancer for a reason. There's no reason anyone has to get sick, injected with chemicals, blasted with radiation, undergo surgery, be saddled with huge medical bills and emotional trauma. I think we have to find a reason to live every day. Live with purpose. Provide others with opportunities to live a life with purpose. I received a phone call that changed my life. It's one I wish I could have hit the ignore button, but that was the wrong number. The scary part is anyone could have received that phone call. This past summer, I traveled to Alaska with my brother and his girlfriend. We're flying down the Alaskan Highway, radio jamming to views of majestic snow-covered peaks. We just camped for 2 nights deep in Denali National Park. In the car, I looked at my phone and I saw I had a voicemail. And the voicemail was a message from Charlie Whitmer from above beyond Cancer. He wanted to invite me and my 71-year-old dad in Nepal with his group of cancer survivors and caregivers. As we sped past some of the most majestic snow-capped mountains in North America, in a place affectionately known as the Last Frontier, I knew something bigger awaited my father and me. Asia is halfway around the world. This is as far away as one can get before one comes back. It took me 10 years to be happy I got the call I had to cancer. It took me less than a second to be happy I heard from above and beyond cancer. As I hung up the phone, I know that this phone call was also to change my life for the better. On our journey to Nepal, we put one foot in front of the other 1 million times as we walked towards Indrasay at 20,300 feet. Every day, I have a smile on my face through the happiness and the hardships of the journey. I no longer worry about how I will be remembered at my funeral. The journey to Nepal solidified my understanding, one that began forming when I was diagnosed, that what is important to me is existing in the present moment and connecting significantly with the people and the world around me. Thank you.
For those of you who are able to stick around, I know that our writers would be happy to answer any questions you might have. So feel free to stick around if you have a question for Ruth and Andy. They're somewhere. Ruth is over here, and Andy.
I can come up.
Yeah, you guys can come on.
We really have a question.
Yeah. So please feel free to stick around if you have to come up. Thank you for coming out today. Does anybody have a question?
I was also Andy's roommate for about 30 seconds.
I don't know what that says about Andy.
I've been married for 40 years.
I told her she could stay. This is wild. And then I came back and I think her roommate was sleeping in my tent.
Yeah.
Okay. Then I got back and she left.
Does anybody have it? Yeah.
Ruth.
Yeah.
You said that after you had the amputation, you learned to do all these things, and one of the things was to put on makeup. And what I want to know is, after you had cancer in your arm and it's been amputated, why are you still putting on makeup?
Well, you know, I like the way I look better than you. I thought perhaps that I would have to introduce myself to the people who accompanied me to Nepal, because for those few years, I think I did not wear makeup. And if you saw that ABC piece that played down here in Des Moines, my recollection when the photographer stuck that microphone in my face and said, "So Ruth, how was that final rock climb?" My recollection is that I said, "There are very few perks that come with amputation, and a little extra help from the Sherpa is one of them." And so when I saw that piece on the TV, and I was going, "There are very few." The memory goes, and I looked terrible. I mean, I looked, you know, great. I was at 19,200 feet, but other questions that you have?
Have they put these experiences together and a book and photographs, photography. Are they doing that?
It's in the works.
It didn't work.
We right now have a team book that we do for each trip, but we're working towards an anthology of published work from above and beyond center writers. We're putting together the questions that we see.
200 pages, that's the second part of this evening. We'll be reading all 198.
Minus 17 pages.
There's also like a Facebook, you can go on Above and Beyond and see a lot of photos from the trip, and they have a video from Kilimanjaro for about 20 minutes, and they have on one of the gentlemen filmed the journey as a 5-part series on his Vimeo site, John Richards. It's under the Above and Beyond channel, and it's spectacular. Really cool. So I'm sure we could probably get you that website.
There's another question. Yeah.
I don't know what it was like to find the, what, the last, was it 800 feet? Give me your
experience. It's 1,200 feet there.
Yeah, so we get up at the crack of dawn, 12 o'clock, we're on the trail at 1:30, it's pitch black, and luckily for us it was pitch black because our route was straight up from the morning through the rocks, and there were some really cool parts for our monk with Dr. Deming. The Sherpa goes, be very careful here. This is where lots of people die. And you can't see like these sheer cliffs to your left and your right. And when they say something that's worrisome, your anxiety goes up. Because usually it's like, oh, you're fine when you're keeled over puking from the elevator. So it was really neat to get up to Crampon Point, and we got up to these ice crevasses. And I have some photos on my phone I can definitely show you. That are literally 50 to 100 feet, you can't even see the size. We rope off in teams of 5. And it's legitimate glacier travel when you're up at that elevation and in that coldness. And you come up to the last pitch that we've asked about, and it's up to 80 degrees. So we have zoomers and ascenders on a rope, so you don't fall backward, you can only go forward. And you're just kicking your feet in, and the elevation's tough, you're trying to breathe, and you got people roped to you, so you're trying to keep a steady pace, not go too fast, not too go slow, look around still, try to capture a couple of photos. But it's spectacular, and after all you've been through, I mean, two nights before, I was puking my brains out, and just felt terrible from the elevation, I think. You're just so motivated to be there and experience a country that had 8 of the 10 tallest peaks in the world, being surrounded by people who just hiked over 2.5 weeks for and shared intimate moments and conversation. And, you know, you learn more than probably you would in 10 years of growing up with somebody in that amount of time. So it's super special. It was a tremendous challenge and a sense of accomplishment to be up there and be surrounded by that. And it felt safe, too, because you had people that were in their 20s that had climbed Everest 7 times and reached the summit. So we had the dream team of Sir Sherpas by Above and Beyond contracting with the top guiding groups wherever they go to make sure it's a safe, professional, really good experience. Does that kind of capture it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Other questions?
What was the highest altitude you reached?
The highest altitude, the summit of Inge Thay was 20,400 is what I read.
20,400.
And I reached 19,200.
Yeah, once you're above 18, I'll feel the same here.
Yeah.
Did you have oxygen?
No. No, there wasn't. I'm sure that they had oxygen available if anybody needed it, but we didn't have oxygen.
Yeah, so they did have some tanks in reserve if people needed it down at the base camp, and the Sherpas did carry it. But at the elevation, it's not necessary for even us, anyone in this room, to really have to use it. You just walk slower. Yeah.
So the question for you. About your writing, I was interested in your choice essentially not to talk about going up the mountain, you know, that, I mean, that is where you end your piece, but you also have so much for us in the essay. And so I'm just like, can you talk about that? Why it struck you?
Yeah, Yasmina kept it really open in terms of what you would write about and how it would affect us. And it's been a long journey for me over 10 years to be okay with having cancer. I've always been okay with it and always been happy to work, but I've never been able to, like, 7 years out to plan more than 5 years ahead. And it's most striking to me because often I think it'd be great for me to help other people be able to make those plans so they don't get to a point where, like, I feel behind my peers. So I'm not married. I don't have a house, and all these things that you're supposed to have. And it's kind of cool also walking with Dr. Deming, because he's like, well, that's where you are, and that's where you need to be. And that's kind of a nice answer, that's the counseling answer I get from a school counselor, but sometimes it's not enough. So what helped me a lot was kind of working through multiple drafts, getting feedback on that piece of my journey, because that's the piece that, at the moment, I probably have to overcome. Before I get to, like, the next stage and have more time to reflect on the journey and what it means to me.
Yeah.
I want to reflect on your whole essay and your last statement, because to me it's the heart of what it's all about, and that statement just can be committed. Mm-hmm. And that just means a lot.
Yeah,
it means a lot. Thank you, thank you.
So Ruth and Andy, can you say something about Buddhism, that as we journey up in the mountains, you know, that was a religion that was the most present in terms of what we were experiencing overtly in the villages, and with the Sherpas, and you mentioned the climb up the final mountain. As he was chanting in the dark, and he had his Tibetan prayer, and he was chanting all the way up in the dark. But is there anything that you take away from that part of the journey?
I am a woman of faith, and I practice my faith in the tradition of the Lutheran Church and the ELCA, but that's where I grew up and that's what I know, and I kind of like it. But I have always been very open to examining what other world religions have to say, and I really believe that the God that I believe in did in fact create it all, and is our way of bringing some answer to the unanswerable question, which is why religion exists. And so I was very intrigued to go to Nepal and experience a Buddhist culture. And I was, as I said in my essay, truly taken by this group of people who just were so aware and so present and so compassionate in being together with us. There was nothing subservient about the Sherpa. They were the authority, but they served in absolutely the most genuine, compassionate way that I could ever imagine being served. And I think that their connection to everything, their connection to where they are. In fact, I don't know, Andy, if it was you, maybe I don't want to take your line. There's somebody who asked, you did ask it.
She's giving
you the line. Okay, so I love everything. But somebody asked, you know, the Sherpa, what do you take with you when you summon?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay, okay, it was you.
No, yeah, go for it.
And the answer was, you only take your heart. And I mean, it just, that is such a powerful statement. It's such a powerful statement about how to move through life with all the summoning that we do every day, everything that we are confronted with, and all those zero spots, and all those mountains, and all those rocks. That's what I took away.
No, that's great. That's a great memory. So I grew up Catholic, and I went to a Jesuit high school, so that probably explains a lot. my freshman English teacher was kicked out of the order. The Dalai Lama said, like, when people ask about religion, he says, "My religion is love." And that just captures everything, because it seems in this day and age we make up so much of the ritual and ideas of what has to be done and by whom and when and where and what fashion. But if you look at doing it with others and with compassion, which means it's like the heart and soul of what Dr. Demi does, that's where you find the human connection with yourself and with others and with the earth. And if you can always remember that being the most important thing, that's pretty tremendous. And one of the best things, if you do get to Nepal or other Eastern countries, please get away from the cities. Because in the cities, you can get the prayer, what's it called, like, the shawl? Is it shawl? And often you'll pay for them as like a donation and things. And you'll see a lot of people asking for money and you take the pictures of somebody. But when you really get out into the countryside, it becomes a lot more real. And you're doing it because it's important to you. And you'll pass by tablets and rocks that have like scriptures and markings. And you'll touch the rock and touch your head as a remembrance. You don't have to do that when you're out in the countryside. But you do it because it's important to you and it's a way of being. And it was so rhythmic, and often with the chanting that would go on the hikes, it would create a pattern of step of a very good time. And you lose yourself into, like anything, when you're really into something, like just reading or sports or being with someone you love, you just keep going and moving, and that's the kind of good way. And people always look at life, I spent some time in Malawi, and people always say, how can people be so happy and have so little? And it's because if you have compassion and you like the people you're around, you can do anything and enjoy any moment. So if you're looking for a job, college students, make sure you like the people you work with. The biggest predictor of job satisfaction.
Yeah. So the Sherpas chanted while you were climbing?
Not all of them. Not all of the time. But there was a certain amount of chanting that went on. And I certainly was aware of Lakpa chanting behind me the whole time he was trying to get me up that ladder. And it was powerful. It was powerful.
Mm-hmm. What was the chanting?
Sorry, I can't tell you what the words were, maybe.
I would think that I mean that is the traditional Om Mani Padme Om.
I don't know what it was.
He might have been saying,
"Oh gosh, I hope this old lady."
All these people here outside.
Yeah.
I just like some advice. I mean, for those of us, I'm sure there's some in the room, who have not faced the kind of adversity that you face in your lives, that has motivated you to come to a kind of peace and understanding with the world and the people you encounter. So that those of us who still occasionally want to, like, knock heads together, what can you tell us about how not to knock heads together? How not to be frustrated or angry or impacted by situations or people that drive us up walls? What can we learn from you that doesn't require us necessarily to have gone through what you've gone through? Or do you still feel that?
Yeah. A lot of times I feel that.
I like to think that we would experience whatever it is that we are experiencing. And if what we're experiencing is anger, then we would experience anger. If what we're experiencing is frustration, then we would experience frustration. The trick, I think, the secret, I think, is to experience that moment and then get over it. And then get on with it. Not holding grudges. And I think, again, in the Buddhist tradition, the idea that whatever it is that we see in the faces of other people or the things that drive us up a wall, it's usually a mirror holding something back. And in meditation, when you have an opportunity to sit and be, you will sometimes have some of those things that will bubble up and you let them go and you just become more aware. And it is living with an awareness, living with acceptance of whatever it is that happens. And I think the most significant lesson for me in the 20 years of cancer journey that I have taken, and certainly there were other things before that, and there have been other things. Cancer is not the worst thing that's happened in my life. But I think to realize, to acknowledge the event, name it, speak of it, gather resources, and to listen to the voices of wisdom that are around you and out there in the world and in the community, and know that wisdom has no age requirement, and then pay attention to when things aren't going well, and pay attention to the resources that seem to help you move forward, because the next time you experience something that's hard, hopefully you can use those same resources and build new ones. That's why I always say that, you know, when you go through a narrow spot, your sand is going to refine and redefine, and you'll find things there that you never knew were there before. But it's about paying attention and being present.
That's a good answer. I would say if you know to ask a question, you know the answer.
And the other Buddhist phrase that goes along with that is, when the student is ready, the teacher will come. Yeah.
Thank you for those profoundly moving stories, Ruth and Andy. I found myself thinking about and feeling so many things as you were reading. One of those things, strangely enough, is the theme for next year's comparison project, which is ineffability, the inability to put things into words.
I was about to ask you what that meant.
He didn't know how to formulate a question.
I'm getting there. I wonder if you could share experiences that you had in recounting these stories and telling these stories where you felt unable to put experiences into words.
If I knew how to put them into words, it'd be in words. So I have no idea.
There you go.
That's really a good answer. I think that as I have worked on writing, I've been sharing the larger message of cancer and change and the inevitability and the effort that gets put into transformation pretty regularly for 3 years, but really speaking about my cancer story for the 10 years since my diagnosis of cancer. And what amazes me is that I can put things down on paper, but it's when I hear them coming out of my mouth that often I will find myself crying because the emotion is so real and so just there. And for some reason, hearing it come out of my mouth has a whole different emotional thing for me than putting it down on paper. And I think that I have been surprised in this process, really, really coming up with the words of how to describe what that experience with the Sherpa meant to me. I know that it was meaningful. I know that, you know, I want to be them. And I can't be them. But just that awareness of being present and doing what is there for you to be able to do. There's more there. And I have to meditation on it, I have to, you know, think about it, I have to write about it, and then hopefully it will crystallize, solidify, you know, come into some being.
I think the piece we said, there's more there, like with the writing project with Yasmina and Judith and different people saying, hey, in this area, Like, I want more. I don't know what I want, but I want more here. And that helps us to create more. And you can't do that without putting more into the world and have it compete. And that's pretty cool.
Did you ever feel that there were things you shouldn't put into words, that you would do, be unfaithful to them? Were you to do so, that you would sully them? They were too sacred or painful or something like that?
No, probably embarrassing.
No, it's true. Yeah, one thing I didn't put in is like going to donate sperm with my mom in the car. And I thought about it. And I'm just like, I'm not going to stand up here and say that.
And I offered both of my breasts and my husband's testicles. And you know, that didn't go over too well either. Yeah.
I'd like to ask Dr. Denny, what is your next journey in this?
Well, thank you for asking. So our next journey is a little run. So last year we did a little bike ride, 3,000 miles, but it was limited to only 8 people that could do that bike ride, and it was part of a race. This year we're doing a run that's going to start at the Pacific Ocean, and it's going to go 4,000 miles and end at the Atlantic Ocean. And it is called the Million Dollar Marathon, and it is not limited to 8 people. And in fact, everyone in this room can be part of that. So there'll be cancer survivors and caregivers coast to coast that will be running this 4,000 mile relay run across the United States.
Do you get to carry a torch?
We will be carrying a baton. Although we're still trying to figure out how should it have some particular shape. But we're not going to do it with fire.
Okay.
So that's the Million Dollar Marathon, and you'll be hearing more about that. And you can go to our website, and anyone who's interested in being a runner or participating, we invite you to do so. There's some information in the brochure that will give you a brochure that has some more information about that. And then we're looking at a more conventional journey this fall, maybe going to South America, Inca Trail to Machu Picchu, for cancer survivors and caregivers. I think these journeys, I love the mind, body, spirit aspect of these journeys. The mountains, is often a metaphor that a lot of people use for difficulties in life. Many cancer survivors, before we ever started doing this, would use climbing a mountain as a metaphor for their cancer journey. And sometimes climbing a mountain is a metaphor, and sometimes it's actually climbing a mountain. And there's adversity associated with that, and being out into the wilderness opens up that connection to nature, and also going to a foreign country and a culture, whether it's Nepal, whether it's the Incas, and then being in a magical, mysterious, sacred place like Machu Picchu also helps open up the dimension of thinking about life less materialistically and more universally. So,
are there other programs nationally or internationally similar to yours? And you have special sponsors. These things are not free.
We're a not-for-profit organization, and we rely on philanthropy of individuals and organizations to help sponsor and provide funding. We're not an adventure travel company for cancer survivors, so it's important to us that every journey isn't just about adventure travel for those on the trip, that this organization elevates the lives of everyone touched by cancer, and that we have to be doing something more than climbing a mountain. And so part of it is the inspiration that can influence others to join us in the real issue. So the issue is not that there's a shortage of cancer survivors on the tops of the mountains, and we could just correct that and balance the world better. It's that cancer will kill 600,000 Americans next year. It's that 1.6 million people will be diagnosed with cancer. And if we can use these stories and these words and images to help bring others along with us to do the real work that needs to be done. And that's talking about prevention. One-third of all cancers in the United States is still caused by tumor microbes. One-third of all cancers in the United States is caused by inactivity and obesity. So it's advocating for that. It's advocating for access to health care. We can have the best treatment for cancer, but if you've got 30 million people in this country who have no health care, then it doesn't matter how, what sort of a cure you have. So it's using our stories, using their stories, to help bring others, to help us advocate for preventing cancers that can be prevented, curing cancers that can be cured, and thinking about life in a way that will hopefully make all of us reach, find the Sherpa within us, and reach out with generosity and compassion to others. So that's what we're hoping to accomplish. And people who are inclined can help us by joining the cause, by making a contribution on our website, by running, by coming to Advocacy Day, by writing a letter to your editor to support Medicaid expansion. Not to get political about it, but hopefully our journeys are the pebble that create the ripple. And in the red folder that you have in front of you, there is a page that tells you all of the different things that you can do to become involved and get engaged. So, thank you for the question.
Have you received any responses or reactions to your editorial?
To the letter and the editor, the letter to the editor, the op-ed piece on Wednesday, I received only favorable comments. So I haven't gotten any emails or calls from Governor Bramstad yet. So I'm interested in what his opinion will be, but just favorable remarks. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for reading my opinion.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. And I think there might still be some drinks out there. So there's some goodies out there.